Exactly. Yep.
Yeah.
So yeah, bring me up to date with what's been going on for you since we last talked. What's been happening? What's God been saying? What have you been thinking? Just kind of catch me up to date.
Yeah, so I mean, since we talked probably 4 weeks ago, I've been traveling again. I had to suffer for Jesus and go to the Masters Golf Tournament and watch Rory McIlroy again prove that he's not the world's number one, which is breaking my heart. Yeah, so I've been traveling, and then I had 3 days with my kind of three best friends in ministry. They all run large Christian camps. One of the guys that runs Glen Eyrie there out of Colorado Springs. We were all together for 3 full days just to catch up. And then I was meant to be with the other 9 directors that all were flying in. But I felt I'd been away from home enough, and I said to the guys, I'm going to just stay for our small group, and then I want to get home. So I headed home a week early, and that felt the right thing to do and was wonderful, actually.
Good.
So,
so let me ask you now, because it's been, like you said, I think it's been about a month.
Yeah.
Has your quest, your question, your search changed any, honed any, or is exactly the same? How would you describe what you're really looking for in this time with you and I and just in this time in general?
Yeah, I think a couple of things because of my attention deficit disorder and because of being a visionary, those two things make it very difficult to sit down and be succinct and bring focus. So what you tend to do is you tend to live from a gut level and an intuitive level. And that's by, you know, God's grace has served me very well. The two-pronged thing is I'm getting more and more people approaching me saying, can you help me with my calling? I don't know what I'm doing. All my emerging leaders work is entering into this conversation. Like, I mean, Gary, it's silly, actually. Like, if I could have you sitting beside me, you know, you would go, John, like, you know, you're doing the right thing going through the calling, you know, process. Because I'm dealing with, you know, leaders now saying to me, listen, I need some help. I'm trying to think, what am I meant to do? So I can give it to them from the intuitive side. But I can't give it to them with a structural side. And what I'm missing in my journey is to try and commit this and articulate it succinctly. So I think what you said to me last time, you said, John, like you seem pretty good on what your calling is. What can I help you with? And I think I said to you, help me articulate it.
Mm-hmm.
Just so that I can just say, you know, that's it succinctly. You know, so every morning I get up, Gary, I go to my bathroom, which is in the basement. The secret to all marriage is don't share the bathroom with your wife. And so I came down, and my wife built my own bathroom down the stairs. She has all my clothes down there. And that's amazing how it's worked out. And so I stand in front of my mirror, and above my mirror, you know, taped to the bathroom, which you can imagine why it wouldn't work in her bathroom, me destroying it. But it says, I am only fully alive when my wings are fully stretched in total dependency on God for his glory alone. So that's where God's called me to live, right? Like stepping out of the nest and allowing him to raise me up on his mighty eagle's wings. And so But as I enter this next sphere where you're going through that life transition of turning 52, you know, you're now realizing, you know what? You know, you got friends that are being told, you know, in their 50s, you got pancreatic cancer, you got 6 weeks to live, you've got, you know, and you're going, if God spares me and I have at best 20 years here till I'm 70, you know, and I think we all know at 70 things can really rapidly change. But I'm going, that gives me about 10 to 15 years of solid moving forward with our ministry, what is it and where is it I'm going to spend my time that will truly ally me? And I think one of the struggles I've had is to determine what am I uniquely made for, given this very bizarre context I have where I'm leading our family ministry, and what is it within our large Christian ministry I should uniquely do that is unique to me? And so it's getting that articulated at another level and saying, yes, this is where I should spend the next 10 to 15 years of my life. Because then what we're going to do, Gary, and this is where it's quite serious, we're going to then build a team to jettison off what I'm not going to be doing and build a team for future succession. So this is a very good time for me to stop and say, okay, John, where are you spending the next 10 years from 52 till 65, so to speak? You know, where is it you're going to put your head down and say, this is my unique contribution given our context? Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does. So what have people been saying to you, both with the guys you just got together doing these retreat centers and all these kind of things, and then your spiritual direction class? What, just in either formal or informal conversations, have guys been kind of offering what they see about you, who you are, your unique contribution or anything, or not really?
We did an extensive interview with 30 people about 5 years ago, and the Center for Ministry out of Philadelphia, Jay Dasko, he was my chair of my master's. He interviewed about 30 people that knew me, and it was around, actually, you know, where's John effective, where's John not effective? And mm-hmm. out of that conversation, you know, what I'm known for is I'm a visionary. So visionary, strategy, you know, leadership development. But what has come clear to me in the last 4 weeks, and I might have told you a story about going to the event with this big event that happened in Toronto, and the guy said to me at the end, you know, I'm doing this because of you. And so I got together with him after, and he said to me, John, whatever you do, you know, you keep talking about emerging leaders, but he said, I think you're probably more called to work with high caliber leaders. And he goes, but you never talk that way. You always talk about you work with, you know, the 20-somethings. He said, but he goes, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing the way I'm doing it if I didn't have you mentoring, coaching, and doing spiritual direction with me. So that was a wonderful little gift. Mm-hmm. And, you know, are you familiar with the One Life people?
You know, no, I don't think so.
Yeah, so they took the Grove Institute Personal Compass and they recreated it for Christians. I just came across it while I was going. But I was just doing some work with them on developing some stuff. And at the end of it, I just happened to say to Sharon, I said, you know, Sharon, I'm starting to work with a chap called Gary Barklow. And I said, I'm really trying to define what I meant to do. And I said, I think it is around coming alongside individual leaders to really mentor, coach, and particularly do spiritual direction with them. But I said it's unique to the fact that I run a large organization, and that's what they love. The fact that I'm not off to the side. I'm in the midst of actually having to work this out in the realities of being a Christian leader running an organization. And I said, and I think God's inviting me to trust that he's going to bring people to me. So we got off the phone. My phone goes, literally, 30 seconds, like Gary, 30 seconds at most. And it's one of the senior executive pastors of one of our largest churches in Toronto. He said, John, I just came out of a meeting. He said, you know, it was a tough meeting. I was thinking about it, and you came to mind. Can we get together? I need you to help me think through some stuff. So when you ask me what's happened in the last little while, both Paul kind of saying to me, John, don't forget about the leaders that you should be working with and can work with, like me, don't just think it's about younger leaders, because my context is a Christian camp. So 20s and early 30s are really it's where I naturally find myself. But right. And then to get this call from this other executive pastor saying, I need some time with you, I need to help. That was a real sense of confirmation. And so I think that I want to articulate, and this is the key piece, what is it within that context that is unique that I do with them? That's the piece, Gary, we've got to articulate. Right, so if your specialty is in the calling side, what is my unique piece I'm going to play? What do I do with them? I'm an encourager. I'm an inspirer. I'm a strategist. I'm just thinking, I want to articulate that.
Yep.
We might say, look, at the end of the day, John, you just go with your, I'm an ordained minister, right? You know, you just go with your gut and be available and trust that God will ask you. But let's kind of say, because what I need to do then is articulate this in a way where I can say, I'm available for this. What are you available to do? Well, I'm a mentor, coach, spiritual director to executive leaders. What is that? And that's where we're going. I think that's where we should head.
Yep. Okay. Good. Well, and one of the things that I wrote down from our last conversation toward the end is you said, you know, because we talked about all the experiences that you've had, the places you've been taught, mentored, classes, and so on, and you just said, well, what I really want to do is explore my desires at the deepest level and understand what they're saying about who I am. So part of the reason for this picture exercise, I don't know if I explained this before, was that, you know, often what happens as we work through things, the mind is very busy editing every thought. What's a good thought? What isn't a good thought? What is accurate, inaccurate? What would be disappointing? What would be, get the approval of the masses? Our mind just goes through all these filters so quickly with every thought. And that's why we're so dependent on other people to help them. For them to help us understand or back it up and say, no, that was important. Let's go back to that. I see you're avoiding that or whatever. But the picture exercise, what happens is, and I know you use pictures in some of the leadership development you do, but the picture exercise allows the heart to speak through images that the mind just doesn't know what to do with. It can't mess with it in many ways. So it's really just an opportunity to hear the voice of the heart without other voices around it. So here's what I want to do. I'd like to go, let's say in about 35 minutes, you have 35 pictures. That's a minute per picture. It may take less than that, each one, but let's just say in 35 minutes. I want you to walk me through your pictures. Just explain the pictures. I'm going to ask some questions about the different ones. I've been looking at this, but I want to, now with this key word, I want you to talk to me about each one. And you have them in front of you, right, like you said?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
And again, just to kind of remember the process here, is what we want to do is just, I just want to collect as many dots as I can, just dots,
right,
pieces of information about you. And so that's why we started with your story, and there's more with that, and we're going into these pictures, which really hits desire and so on, and these other exercises. And then when we have enough, or as many as we can get, then we'll start connecting those. But so many people rush to connecting the dots, and they just haven't collected enough yet. And that's what society does anyway, our culture. So,
Gary, let me just say something to you.
Yeah.
I take personal development in others so seriously that I one of the great things that even my board have said that I put myself under that same learning and openness to be mentored and coached. So I just let you know, like, don't worry about what I've done or what I do with people. Take me right into it. I'm a very, by wiring, I'm a student at heart. So feel free to just take me right into it, and let's trust the Spirit here.
Yes. Yep. And the only thing I'm looking for in the past, the things you've done, is what has God already revealed to others. So you betcha. We'll do that.
Yeah.
So let's start. Let me make sure I'm at the top of this too here. Let's start at the very top of your pictures here. Hold on. I got to get back to where I can see this again in a better way. Okay. So, yep. So let's start with your pictures, and let's go to there. No, better. So let's go to your first picture called Contemplation. Describe the picture to me a little bit more. What do you see in it?
It's the idea of solitude and silence that is so vital to my well-being. And without solitude and silence, I cannot live or breathe or survive.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask you, is this guy, would you imagine, is this picture taken at dawn or dusk, would you think? It looks like it's one of those to me. Now, maybe to you it's not looking like one of those.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a morning person. I'm a night owl. But to me, you know, this definitely has that, the morning, you know, this is the fog in the morning at the lake, so.
Okay. Okay. So contemplation, time alone. In your time alone, what is it that goes on for you that seems to be most valuable, that you need the most?
It's certainly, I mean, it's how I hear God. It's how I declutter my brain. And it's how I build up the energy and reserve to move out into an extroverted world. Because I am deep inside an introvert in an extroverted role.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. Okay, next picture, number two. So you're the one in between, it's called.
This is my whole calling in life. I think I mentioned this too. The little book I just wrote is called Leading from the In-Between. And mm-hmm. It's the idea that the greatest leverage a leader can have is when they find themselves in in-between places. And I love being in in-between places. I'm wired for in-between places. And I think the greatest opportunity to lead is in the in-between places. So I'm caught, I'll give you an example. I'm caught between growing up as a very deep, rich evangelical, but I love to hang out with people that are as far from God as you can imagine. That in-between place, I'm really comfortable there. I'm called there. And I love being in that. And the whole camp is designed around being an in-between place.
Okay, so and describe, because you had mentioned this phrase before, which is a fascinating title and phrase, but you really want to help people in their in-between places. So describe a person in an in-between place.
Well, particularly leaders that are stuck where they don't recognize, they're so beaten up and beaten down, or they're overwhelmed, or they're just caught up in the distress of being in leadership, and I know that I just love to help them find what is this in between place you're in, and what let's see what we can see, and what's the next step to build out, you know, a bridge and a structure from this place towards health or towards effectiveness or towards the next stage. So I don't tend to do a lot of consulting on people in their organization. I end up helping people be effective as a person in their leadership reality. So that's where I tend to be much more of a mentor, coach, spiritual director than I do a consultant, strategist mm-hmm. kind of thing.
So describe what are we literally seeing here? What is the picture literally?
Well, it literally looks to me like it's I'm hoping it's a bridge, but it looks like it's a lit bridge, and it's the underneath of the bridge with a lake underneath it, but it could be not that at all now that I look at it.
Well, actually, that was my impression. We're seeing the reflection of the bridge on the water, but okay. Okay.
Yeah. So it's someone looking from underneath, and the bridge is going over the top, and, you know, and someone cleverly has lit up the bridge underneath to reflect on the water, and I just thought it looked like trees in the background in a cottage, and I thought, you know what, someone's just taken this bridge and made it a lot brighter, and a lot, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, the third one, labeled Winston.
My hero is Winston Churchill. I love the idea that he was the right person at the right time, and, you know, he served his purpose and using his oratory mouth skills. I love him because, like me, he was a portly guy who really enjoyed cigars, and at the right time of the right moment, in devotion of, you know, his country, he stood in that gap. And I think, you know, that line where he, you know, when Chamberlain came to him and said, I need you to take over, and he said, I feel as if all my life was preparation for this one moment. Mm-hmm. I that when I read that in his biography, that went deep into my soul, that like Esther, you know, the right person at the right time, and in that moment was able to stir fear, stir Nazis, stir Hitler in the face and move people. I love that concept. I go to his museum and his underground museum every time I'm in London and could spend days in there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So obviously in the random, I don't know if you use that random generator or how you found the pictures, but you didn't see a picture of Winston Churchill, but you saw this, and that's where you went, was Winston Churchill. Okay, because, right, he was called the Bulldog.
Yeah, and that's right. And, well, the British Bulldog was his symbol, but, you know, the Bulldog, you know, is the one animal that it can bite onto you because its nose slanted back. It can breathe without letting go. And I think, you know, just the British Bulldog was Winston Churchill's kind of, you know, metaphor, kind of like, you know, he wouldn't let go, and he didn't. And in the end, you know.
Yep. Okay, the fourth one, which you put the word careless on.
Yeah, I just read an article in a magazine about these eight people that died in the Canyonlands there just back last year. And I thought about the young guy, I remember, where the rock fell on top and he had to cut his arm off.
Right.
And my friend, who's one of the leading outdoor experts in North America, he was with a group and they got caught out. And he said to me afterwards in the Canyonlands, he said, John, we were the leading experts. And he said, the guy that was our guide had to call for search and rescue. And it was his students from the university had to come get him. And he said, how did experts in outdoors and the professor of outdoor who was on the search and rescue team get himself into that situation? He said, complete carelessness. And I want to help people from just being careless.
Okay. I'm amazed. So it's the picture, it captured you, not because you love the picture, but it just instantly made you think of that story and helping people who are careless in the situation they get themselves in.
Yeah, and prevent people from getting into those situations.
Okay. Okay. All right, so the next picture, which is, right, number five, you just 007. Tell me about why that picture. Tell me about it.
James Bond. His Majesty, you know, in His Majesty's Secret Service, right? I, serving King Jesus, to me, Our Majesty. And Gary, I have a little thing that someday, you know, so I run an organization. It's completely pretend, but it's called the KIA. And it's called the Kingdom Intelligence Agency. And I'm not joking. We have official, like, properly done, like, police badges. And I famously, you know, with a bunch of my guys, you know, we talk about like we serve in the kingdom of God, and it often moves in ways. So I'm drawn into that world, and I don't know if I mentioned that too. I was part of a team that collated information on terrorists, so that's kind of my background. So you imagine I'm drawn naturally into that side. So when I saw Big Ben, I thought, you know, straight away of James Bond 007, and you know, the first James Bond movie was in Her Majesty's service, and I serve at the pleasure of the King of Kings, Lord of Lords, and I'm part of His kingdom, and it is at work in ways we cannot see, and we are called at times to serve that kingdom, protect that kingdom, and allow it to work quietly. And a lot of my work, I guess, which I've never thought about till now, I'm the guy that people sometimes in leadership share stuff with that they couldn't share with someone else. Secrets of the heart, secrets of their organization. You know, I just left a leader this morning. He said, I'm going to tell you something that's going on in the organization that I can't tell too many people. You know, so that's very typical for me to be entrusted with stuff that they can't share, but they need to share in order for me to help them. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So what is it you love most about – now we're talking about a movie here, but, you know, I'm talking about something other than that, that kind of the world of 007, or as you started, the KIA thing. What is the element of that that's most intriguing, most captivating, most enthralling about that for you?
So – if you ever get invited to be in the KIA, you get a letter in the mail, and the letter says that members of the KIA – now you're going to think I'm crazy, Gary, but it's kind of –
No, I'm not. I'm intrigued. I'm loving this. Yeah.
So it basically – it says that we work behind the scenes to enhance, incur, and ensure that we or others don't do damage to the kingdom of God. So, you know, it's kind of coming alongside each other and cheering each other on and occasionally coming alongside each other and saying, Gary, that wasn't you at your best. And so to me, you know, I'm just entrusted at times with secrets that could harm someone or harm a ministry or could harm something. And I'm asked to give advice into that. So it's less to do with the 007 thing than it is truly to say, you know, it's sometimes the kingdom goes forward, you know, because leaders have to confess stuff or have to share stuff or have to, you know, so, you know, without breaking confidentiality, I was just, assured that, you know, an organization began with a lot of money and they, you know, what should they do with it and what can they do with it? And, you know, I was asked, John, what would you do if you had this money? So there's an example, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so they would never tell anybody else in the organization that someone's potentially giving them this money, you know. So, you know, there's that kind of stuff.
Yep. Okay, so one other question before we move to the next one, and that is this. Most of the time when you're talking about working with somebody, you say that they are a leader. How would you define a leader? So how would you know the person you don't want to work with because they're not, quote, a leader, and who is? So how would you define leadership in that way for you?
Yeah. Well, my actual definition of leadership that the book is about is simply leaders are people who look at their world and say, it doesn't have to be this way. And they do something about it. So I am drawn to leaders who look at their world and go, this isn't right. I got to do something. Or I think, you know, we can't tolerate this anymore. We've got to do something. So I'm drawn to people that begin to see and then begin to say, how do we, you know, change this reality, whether it be a cultural shift, whether it be organizational shift, whether it be starting something. So that's kind of, so I don't do well around half glass empty, negative people, complainers and whiners. I am a kind of, give me a problem, we'll figure out a solution, and then, you know, let's make it, let's see it become a reality.
Okay. Good. Good. That's helpful. Okay. So let's go to the next picture now, which is the one labeled sacrifice, the two biplanes.
Yeah, I love the picture because, I mean, you're going up against an enemy, and one of the two of you is not coming home. So you have to be prepared that it might be you. But then you have that daring factor to go, yeah, well, so be it. And I'm deeply moved, you know, because of my service in my own country to military, to, you know, police, to people that put themselves out there. So when I saw the picture, you know, obviously one per pilot's on his way dying, but the other pilot was willing to put himself out there and was willing to sacrifice himself for a greater good or a greater cause.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. Number seven, the one you labeled express.
Helping people discover their gift and then having the courage to try it and to test it and being vulnerable enough to step up on a stage and find your voice, I find that really gets me excited.
Okay. So again, this idea of step, just being willing to step, to get on stage, to get in front of the light.
Yeah.
Right? Okay.
Yeah.
All right. A Titanic, the boat that's submerged underneath the water.
Well, I grew up in Belfast, so my great-grandfather worked on the Titanic, so he was the quartermaster on the Titanic and didn't go down with it. He was in the shipyard side of it. And so the Titanic, you know, is a big part of the Northern Ireland story. When you walk into my office, I've got a 28-inch replica of one of the lifeboats. That's the first thing you see when you walk into my office. And it just reminds me how easy it is that arrogance can sink things. And, you know, I just toured about 4 weeks ago the Titanic Museum in Belfast, and you know, when you see the radio communications outlined so clearly and to the point where the Marconi guy says, listen, there's icebergs, like you gotta watch out, and the guy said, shut up, and he Morse codes back to him the word shut up. Then you go, you guys killed, you know, 1,500 people because of arrogance, the desire to be the first, to be the best, and you killed those poor people, and arrogance that you thought you'd built the greatest boat, and arrogance. And so I don't want to run an organization that is built on arrogance. And when I first came into the organization, it had that kind of cocky tone.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So... okay, so let me ask you, this is kind of a side question, but going with what you said, what is it that you see, hear, experience that makes you mad when you see it? It's the kind of thing where you say, that should not be like that. That really unsettles me.
Arrogance.
Mm-hmm. So you might hear that in someone teaching or speaking or something written, or where do you typically hear the expression of that arrogance, experience that expression of arrogance?
I think just the idea that people think they're the best and they're better, and the contempt of looking down their nose at people, and I know how to do this, and you know, I've got this, and they're closed to any kind of teaching or learning or openness to feedback. So I do tend to see it in people, And as you know, if you start seeing it in people, it's probably in your own heart.
Right.
We see easy that which we project, so.
Yeah, or at least, I was going to say, at least, you know, we projected it. Now we've acquired a distaste, a nausea over it. So we're very aware of it when we see it, right? And we know we're not impervious to it, but we just, we're very aware of it.
Yeah, and I think it more than dislike, it just frightens me because, I just find it. And the arrogance of someone assuming that what they see is reality, you know, I spend a lot of my time helping myself realize I think I know what's going on, but I don't think I actually do.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I come to you, Gary, right? You know,
mm-hmm.
I run a 4,000 square foot leadership center that everybody comes to, but I'm not going to pretend that I actually, you know, always know what is best or know what to do. And I you know, my pastor friend who's on our board said to me, you know, we as human beings, as God has made us, are incapable of reading our own story accurately.
Mm-hmm.
And so when people presume that they have the story down accurately and they start giving their opinions and don't actually test their thesis, I find that kind of arrogance very, and you know what, you cannot run an organization over the long term in a healthy way with a I've got this kind of spirit or disposition.
Right.
Because you only can lead an organization in a learning mode, because if you're not learning, and I don't mean just learning as teachable, but with an idea that this is my assumptions, they may be wrong, so let's not commit the whole ship to this direction because this assumption could be wrong. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that sounds very much, you know, like that in-between time. Not on the one side where I'm sure everything's right, I see it accurately, but the in-between time is, I would assume, right? I'm not sure that I am seeing this accurately. I'm not sure that my assumptions are correct. That feels like an in-between time. Do you think it is or not really? Or that's a whole different deal.
Well, I mean, just you saying that to me reminds me that is an in-between place, because if you came into our leadership studio with your team, and the first thing I do is teach you about, we all look at something through a framework. We create a framework and then a literal frame, like a picture frame. And I have you look at something and I'll say to you, Gary, what do you see? And then I say, Gary, that's not right. And then I start arguing with you, but I'm not even looking through your frame. And of course, eventually you get the point, right? You're realizing I don't have your framework, but this is what I say, guys, if you want to be effective organizational leaders, you have to take down the frame. If you keep that frame in place, you're going to misread, you're going to, you know, scale up or scale down wrongly. Part of organizational leadership is learning how to take down your framework before you define reality. And that's kind of a big piece of my teaching. I teach that. I don't know if you know the Arrow Leadership Program. That's kind of a big kind of aha moment in leading organizations. So you're right. I am about taking people who think they've got it, and this is beyond the arrogant side, but just truly believe I know what I'm doing. And I go, are you sure?
Mm-hmm.
I listen more to people who offer up and say, can you listen to this? I think I see what's going on. I'd like to offer it up and see what you think.
Right.
That's what you're looking for. Now, there's a moment where I say, Gary, the building's on fire. I've got this. We need to leave.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. Okay, your ninth picture you labeled Elevate. Tell me
about
that.
Well, I just love this guy that is in this beautiful field, but yet there's ladders leading into something else. There's another dimension that you can be elevated to. And to me, it spoke of the kingdom of God.
Yeah. Anything hit you with the idea that he's alone in this field?
No, because I think when you're truly leading, you are often alone. And I don't mean truly leading as in that's only what leaders do, but leaders that have to carry the weight will often find themselves in a lonely disposition and a very lonely place. So therefore, you know, that is part of the realities. I just one of the guys just took over, you know, a very large Christian organization. And I said, listen, I don't have much to offer you, but I'm going to tell you, there's two things that's about to enter your life in a way that you will not experience before. And I said, one will be fear and one will be loneliness. And the guy circled back to me 6 months later and he said, you know, it's funny you said that to me. He said, it's already started. And I said, I know. I said, because at the end of the day, you're not going home and you're carrying the weight and you're having to. So I love this picture and thank you for pointing out he's alone. But look, there's an invitation into another dimension, perspective, relationship with God, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, great. The next one, daring.
Sorry, I managed in.
Oh, number 10. Yeah, number 10,
yep,
daring. Sorry. Yep. Are you in the car, by the way? Are you driving right now?
If you saw where I was sitting, you'd want to come and sit with me. I'm sitting in a park by the lake, and I was going to sit outside. I have when I come on my director's course, I have this park that I go to, and I sit by the lake. And it just so happens they're cutting all the grass and doing all the maintenance, so you'd be hearing lawnmowers going by. So I'm sitting right by the lake on the far side of Toronto, looking across at the city of Toronto in Niagara-on-the-Lake. Have you ever been to Niagara-on-the-Lake?
No, I haven't. Sounds beautiful.
It's one of the most picturesque little village towns in probably in Canada. So, it's my secret. It's one of my secret little thin places in life. So this picture is really interesting. I don't know if you know this picture, but that is the famous footbridge. I believe it's in China that you're not allowed to climb. And I think it's called the Stairway into the Clouds, and it's illegal to climb it, and they keep arresting all these tourist kids that do it. So one of our guys just did it, and he's real mischievous, rebellious. Like, I would have to chain him to one of my deck chairs because the things he does at camp, honestly, would put you and me in my grave. And he's famous for doing, like, climbing up on top of the roof and shooting videos and jumping, like, just stupid stuff, right? And so lately he's been traveling the world. So he just did this staircase and he sent me a picture because he knows it irritates me. And so this footpath goes from way down and it follows the line of that mountain. And you can see either side it drops off and it goes right up top. And I just love the fact of, I guess, Gary, you know, if I were to be forthright, I'm a bit of a rebel, and I think in-between people are a bit rebellious. But I'm deeply respectful of authority, given my service. I I'm one of those guys, you walk into the room, I'll probably stand up. I'm about formality there, given my background, you know, and I'm old school. I can't stand it when I say I was walking you around my office. If people don't stand up, and you know, I've been known to, like, it's the one area where people know. So say we're going, all our staff are meeting, and there's 10 staff in the room, and you and I arrive. These young people, they don't get up. They go, oh, hey. Whereas you and I would get up, and we would walk over and shake hands. There's a maturity thing there. So it's not a rebellious without authority and respect. It's just a sense of, you know what? I like to push the boundaries. And I think that's probably what visionaries do anyway.
Yep.
But I'm not disrespectful or you know, I'm a salute you stand line, but I'm drawn to daring, and I'm drawn to encourage people to dare more.
Okay. Good. Okay, so the next one, which you have labeled, this is picture number, right, 11, roots.
Yeah, I mean, it's Psalm 1, right? You know, I just love the idea of a tree planted by a river that bursts fruit in season, and sinking deeply into Psalm 1, and then bearing fruit in the right season. So, you know, there's just no surviving in the Christian life or Christian leadership without laying down deep roots into the river of God's living, breathing reality in person. And so that's kind of that.
Okay, so let me ask you then. Let me go back to, because when we talked, when you were talking about this idea of carelessness, arrogance, which is obviously a strong point from you, listening to you, the amount of time you spoke on it, the energy in your voice. You know, I would think that those who are arrogant are usually those who have stepped out a little too far at this point in the developmental process. They just want to get there, and typically they're not rooted well. If they were rooted well, deeply rooted, then they wouldn't be arrogant. Though it's a temptation for any of us, of course.
Yeah. Well, there's a character of arrogance, and there's moments of arrogance, right?
Yep. Okay. So one last question. What does a rooted person look like? Now, obviously you said, this is going back to the Psalms, they bear fruit, but describe what they would be like to be around a rooted person versus a shallow-rooted person.
Well, I think I've just been reminded of this by a great guy who just rewrote Andrew Murray's books. I don't know if you know Carlos Waith. You ever heard that name, Carlo Waith?
No. Mm-mm.
So Carlo just rewrote Andrew Murray's books, and he talks about surrender, abiding, humility, waiting, and listening. And I can't think of five better things to put you into a place of deeply rooting your life, right? Surrender, you know, the idea of abiding, the idea of humility, waiting, and then listening. And if Carlo and I am bringing his five books into my leadership development thing. So it's kind of like if you work with me, you're going to be working through these five books. So I would say that's the answer to what does it mean to be deeply rooted.
And give me the five. Surrender, abiding, listening. What were they again?
Surrender, abiding, mm-hmm. humility, waiting, and
yep.
listening.
Okay. Okay. All right. Great. So now the next one, which is precision.
Since I was a child, the kingfisher has been my favorite bird, that and the kestrel. The kestrel, because of its biomechanics, to be able to hover. And then, and so as a kid, I got to watch a kestrel almost every day of my school life during that season. And we used to go and sit and watch the kestrel. But the kingfisher and the beauty of it, but its ability to patiently wait and then at the right time go for the fish. And then I just loved that picture. I thought, you know, I mean, it's dying, probably looks like it's moving there towards 2 or 3 feet. And it saw those fish, and it waited patiently. And then it's perfectly designed to do what it does. And it did it really well.
Mm-hmm. It's a spectacular picture. Well, I assume that maybe part of this is its ability to work in two different environments.
That's really
good. Okay. Okay.
Yeah, I like
The next one.
Which, by the way, Gary, just to play on the in-between place, And it stays in an in-between place. It stays in a tree. It's designed to fly. It's designed to swim. But it has to live in the in-between place in order to do what it needs to do.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, that's really good. Okay, so the next one, the one you labeled critic.
Yeah, this is my evangelistic heart coming out. You know, Mahatma Gandhi in his biography talked about Christianity and then accused us of, you know, if we truly believed, we would live entirely differently. And I think his criticism, you know, is a fair criticism, and it's a criticism that I feel the weight of. If it really is true, then am I becoming, you know, what I should become? And so my heart for Mahatma Gandhi, you know, would obviously be, man, you know, the British imperial system that was so based and rooted on a Christian paradigm, you know, took apart his country and treated his people awfully. But then the best of the British find a way to also help it become what it's become today. But I just, my heart broke for Gandhi, the fact that he was so close to Christianity. And as one guy said, imagine, you know, and I think a story is, if I remember right, they wouldn't let him into church because of the way he was dressed.
Hmm.
And so in his biography, Gandhi, he talks about Christianity and imagine, I got that sense if he was that close, and yet, I mean, where would we have been if Christianity had have seen Gandhi?
Right.
So his criticism was fair, and I think some days we need to get off our high horse and admit that our version of Christianity, while we hold very true to our orthodoxy and evangelical roots, we have not done it in a way that was gracious. If our hearts had a broke when HIV broke out, instead of us quietly laughing up our sleeves and celebrating, and I'm not to say that was your perspective or mine, I'm just speaking generally,
mm-hmm.
I think we wouldn't have had one-tenth the problems we're having today, because we would have said, we'll help you solve this. But instead, we kind of went, see, the judgment of the Lord's upon you.
Right.
And, you know what I mean? And then all of a sudden we realized it was in our children and in, you know, hemophiliacs and whatever. And you turn around and you realize, my goodness, if we had of, yes, held to our conviction, but had of actually served the poor and the needy and brought healing. And that's why I love the Salvation Army. You know, when we finally woke up to say, maybe we should get involved in HIV, we turned the corner and the Salvation Army were already in the hospitals years before holding their hands.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yep. Yep. Okay, stretched, the number 14, and I'm realizing we'll probably have to move here a little quicker. Though this is so valuable,
yeah.
Or we'll do
so
a part. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so stretched is what I said to you, that I'm never really alive as a leader till my wings are fully stretched in total dependency on God for his glory alone. And God has wired me to be stepping out of the nest. And it's kind of one of my famous kind of leadership talks I do about God stirring up the nest. You mean the classical one that we've all preached at some time. But it's just, to me, I realize that, you know, I often find myself in situations where I've just got to go, okay, God, I'm fully trusting you here. Building our leadership studio, right? I mean, no, but it didn't make sense for us as an organization. It made sense philosophically, but it said where we would, should we put our money there? And I really, God, down at, right at Dawson Trotman's grave up there in Glen Eyrie, God spoke to me, and I came down that mountain a different person, and I said, we're doing it, we're launching it. And, you know, it was utter, like, stepping out with our wings fully stretched.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and daring, like you said, you just kind
yeah.
of daring. Okay, Torah, number 15.
My love for Scripture, you know, I'm fascinated that Moses, you know, who let's assume we think as best we can, you know, wrote most of those first five books, and their faithfulness of God was based on those first five books. I just love that. So I just love scripture. I love my line, which I take from Jack, my friend, you know, we lead from the word. And so I'm a very, you know, take scripture very seriously. And that's kind of just who I am.
Okay. Okay. 15 or 16, overflow.
This is a big piece of our philosophy of ministry. Our vision at Muskoka Woods, which is the summer camp ministry, is to be a living exhibition of life with God. And so part of our teaching is that therefore we need to overflow the beauty and character of God. So there is no overflow without inflow. And so we talk about five inflows and five overflows. And that's kind of, at the end of the day, it's about spiritual Christ-like formation. So we built a very simple curriculum around that idea.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm big on, you know, people are fascinated. Why do I, you know, I mean, a fairly well-educated guy still go and take a course on spiritual direction. And why did I go do Renovare? I go overflow. It's like if I'm going to tell people you have to be a learner, then I better practice it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's good. Okay. 17, artistry. Tell me about this picture of this guy.
I just love the fact that, you know, here is a character that you just love to look at him as a person, but here he is with a camera, and I couldn't tell, is this his first time with the camera? Did somebody give it to him? Or, you know, but it was just the fact that someone saw him. And it was probably the photographer gave him his camera. The fact that his arm seems to be broken, it looks like he's a person that lives on the streets, which my wife and I have an affinity and a ministry to. And I just love the fact that the photographer has given him his camera, and the guy's looking down, and he's overcoming his infirmities and situation. And someone saw that the street person can be something. And when you spend time with people that live on the streets, you discover many of them are artists and incredible artists, and that resource and that thing. And so I think that tapping into the artistry of people and what is lying there that's untapped yet really, really grabs my attention.
Okay. Yeah, that's really good. I mean, what you saw in the picture was far more than I saw in that picture. That's fascinating. Okay, so the next picture, I have to pull it up in my grid here.
Collingwood.
So, correct, Collingwood, that one.
So I think it was General Collingwood or Admiral Collingwood was one of the British admirals for the Royal Navy in Britain. And he had the foresight and vision to say that if we're going to have a Navy of the future, we better plant trees today. And those trees in 100 years will continue to build out the Navy. So Collingwood famously was a guy that planted all over United Kingdom oak trees. Now, Gary, before you preach that, check the details of that. I was told that – I like to say that to people because I was told that story when I was doing a wedding for a friend up in Collingwood. And one of the speakers got up and said, you know where Collingwood came from? And he said he was a man that planted trees. And I did read somewhere, but – check the details, but it's kind of one of the things I talk about is what I'm doing today in leading Muskoka Woods in our studio. If it's going to be alive in 100 years, what resources should I be planting today that will get us there?
Mm-hmm. Now, let me just pause here and say I'm fascinated with how, you know, your heart seems to, you've said, you're really passionate about and feel like God is honing your life down to working with individuals or small groups and leaders. And yet the majority of what you describe in these pictures about what moves you and where it takes you is about organizations.
I think my calling, Gary, I'm about support. supporting people that run organizations. I'm myself not about organizing an organization. I think that's where I'm starting to realize. Like, I mean, I run a large Christian ministry. It's a big organization. It's a big ship. You know what I mean? I'd love to get you up this summer, Gary, by the way, to come and spend a day or two with me and come see the place, and I'll fly you up.
That's great.
And just so that I'd like you to just see that. And I'd also like to see our studio, because if there's something for us to do with you in the future and the stuff that you've discovered, because no one's articulating this stuff, I think, as well as you. And I just shared that with my board the other day. I'd like you to come up, but it's a big ship. It's a big machine. And I love it, but the guys will tell you, John is a disaster at the details. Like, he couldn't follow through if you put a gun to his head, but the visionary, the strategy, the philosophy of ministry, the encouraging, the championing, the mentoring, the coaching, the ministry side, that's what John does. But everybody knows. I mean, if I didn't have an assistant, if I didn't have a CFO like Ron Pennycat, like I would have spent every dollar on building the Taj Mahal at our camp and going, what do you mean it costs money to keep it going? I just thought it would look great. So, I mean, obviously I'm mature, but I think that I do not enjoy being caught up on the details, but I am about being a catalyst to people starting things. But then what I'm really about is helping the leader who's running it. How can they sustain the weight and the pressure and the stress of leadership?
Okay. So a leader that you're working with, that's one thing, but that person has to somehow be attached to a cause.
Absolutely.
Is that right?
Yeah, because remember, if they don't have something and they're not doing anything about it, I don't want to be around them.
Okay, so let me ask you.
Hold on a minute. Hold on. No, you know what? You've said it. I've got it. I'm not called to work with a leader in their own personal leadership, devoid of them executing on something. I just had an aha there.
Yep.
Does that make sense?
Oh, completely. I mean, that's what I've been hearing. So if a guy came to you and he was the CEO or whatever of some corporation and just said, I'd love some personal coaching. I just want to be a better leader. Would that interest you very much? Because he's just, leading some corporation, he just wants to be a better leader. Or would that?
Let's go through my people pleasing paradigm and go, well, of course, Gary, I'm a servant. I'd serve anybody, but I think that I'm really passionate and I'm really attracted to people that are in the throes of the difficulty of what it means to be in leadership, leading something. That if I said to you, who have I just spent time with in the past 2 days while I've been in Niagara, because the big Baptist conference going on here right now, four leaders, all who are the heads of their own organizations. That's who I naturally hang out with. That's fascinating.
Okay.
So, Gary, if let me say this right, and if I offend you, can hang up. I wouldn't be as interested in spending time with helping people discover their calling. I would like you to hand me people who have launched their calling and they're 1 year into it and they're falling apart and they're dying a death. And you go, okay, I'm going to introduce you to John McCauley. His area is to help you thrive and survive in the throes of you launching your calling. But I think what you put your finger on is it's using and launching something as opposed to just being something.
Okay.
Right? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So someone discovers their calling and they go out and they're building an organization and then all of a sudden they're going, I'm not doing good spiritually, I'm not doing it. If you said, okay, I'm going to introduce you to John McCauley, you know, he's a organizational leader, mentor, coach, spiritual director for people in the throes of leadership, that would be, I would say, yeah, Gary, that's me.
Okay, so to put a medical model over where we're trying to go, I'm hearing that you would prefer to be maybe a field medic than a surgeon back off the front lines at a major hospital, a major medical military hospital. Or where would you put yourself, putting a medical model over what we're talking about? What kind of physician would you be?
Well, you're certainly speaking my language, so...
So as you're thinking about, right, you have general practitioners and they work in an office with people from birth to death, or you've got a surgeon, or you have a triage guy in an emergency room, or you have a field medic or an EMT, you know,
Well, remember I shared this metaphor with you before about Mr. Holland's opus, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where I said to my mentor, I guess I want to be like Mr. Holland opus, where I'm really writing a symphony in people's lives that I'm not even aware of. And then he said, hi, sad, you're not called to be Mr. Holland Opus. You're called to be the Minister of Education. So a field medic would be too, and I mean this as kindly, it'd be too small, but I would be, but I know what you're saying because they're in the front lines and they're right in there. But I would tend to be a little bit more of the,
kind of the MASH unit, right? The hospital set up right next to the front line, maybe. And again, you don't ever have to worry about offending me. I'm just throwing things out to see what sticks, and you go, yeah, that's it. No, that's not it. So don't worry.
No,
about
the last thing I'm interested in is ever being a doctor or a medic. So that's why it's a harder thing. So, but when you talk to me about in the battlefield, you know, I'm definitely drawn to the. You know, I'm definitely drawn to the special forces side, you know, and so, you know, if I was a medic, I would be on a medic within the special forces unit, which, you know, I think all men probably deep inside want to be in special forces. But
right.
there's something, I'm a specialist, but I'm also I can be a medic. I could be, you know, I was a marksman. It's interesting, in the police, Gary, I always ended up on the unique units within the police. So, you know, there was about 12,000 of us. I was one of 12, you know, search and rescue divers in the whole of the police force. In the police station I was in, which was probably in one of the top four most dangerous police stations, I served on the collation information that only five of us served on out of a police station of about probably 100 police officers. So I'm always drawn towards the specialist, the uniqueness, the
mm-hmm.
always. In fact, even in high school, I was like that. I was drawn, you know, not just being a student, but I was on the gymnastics team. I was on the canoeing club. I was part of the orienteering team, like anything that was a little bit unique and a little bit differently. So I've always been drawn, but I think, you're right. I would definitely be the crisis guy in the medical. I'd be making the big calls about how to get the resources to the right people and telling people to hang on. We're getting to them. We're going to be there for them, and stirring up people to go out and rescue and bring back and sort out and do surgeries on the field. I would be the kind of I'd be that guy.
Okay. Okay. So if you're special forces, you might be the medic who has special training, but also obviously carries a rifle, a sidearm. I mean, you can fight and you can save a life. You can do both.
Yeah. You know, so for instance, on my unit where we collated information on terrorists, I took up photography. So I did for our unit, I did the photography for us, sort of our group of five. You know what I mean? Like that would be so me. It's not just that I'm on the Bone Patrol, which is the name of our unit, but I and we had a whole photography division, but I did photography, and I took all our own pictures over the terrorists. Like that's just okay. So like there's a uniqueness. There's a, you know, I think the word is like I'm there's a specialist.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you a little story. When I was a kid, I was about 15 years old, and we were in the mountains, and really bad weather closed in, and my teacher, Eddie Officer, who was the head phys ed teacher, he said, we're not going to make it to where the bus was dropped off. And he, you know, there was about 40 high school students, and he said to the bus driver, I need you to go back to the bus. And he goes, I need you to bring the bus to a different place. And the guy said, I don't know how to get there. And he just turned and he said, where's John McCauley? And I said, sir, I'm here. He said, John, come here. And he pulls out a map. He said, get him to there. And I left. And I took this guy, who was a 14-year-old kid, all through the mountains for probably an hour and a half by myself as a kid, and got him to a bus in a different location. And I remember that moment in my life where he called me out and entrusted me with that. And that's because I had this uncanny ability to read maps, and I knew the mountains really, really well as a kid. And so that teachability factor. So I've always had that little drawing into being a bit of a specialist.
Okay. Yep. This is helpful. Yep.
I wouldn't just be the medic. I would be an expert at intubating you while in the field, and I would have to know that I could do surgery on you. You know what I mean? Like, it would be more than just, you know what I mean? And think
right.
about it. Based on right. what you've heard about me, you know I'd be doing training. I'm going, well, how do I open up his throat if I'm in the field to save his life? Like, I would have to go deeper and deeper.
Right.
And Gary, let me say something to you. One of the things that my team said during some of those interviews, they said, what's John's greatest asset he brings this organization? They said, resources.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that. He's very resourceful. Mm-hmm. I raise money. I bring leaders in. Like, I mean, when I introduce your stuff to the thing, they'll go, how do you find this stuff? And I go, I just read. And I, you know, my assistant just called me and said, you ordered 100 books on your sabbatical from your Kindle. And I said, yeah.
Uh-huh.
And she said, you couldn't read 100 books in 4 months. I said, pull up any book and I'll tell you what that book is about, and I'll tell you what the subject matter is. Like, I mean, that's honestly, I am a sponge for information. And I don't read books. I've never read a book cover to cover. I've read about 4 books in my life. I read it because I'm after. You know, I finished your book in Kindle, right? So that's actually not true. I did read one whole book. But I'm after the chapter on, you know, what you said about XYZ. That's usually when I'm reading and I'm looking for something. So.
Yeah. Okay. This is all really helpful. So let me ask you for a minute. Just pause for a second and ask you. So we've worked through, let me just see, we just finished picture 18. We got to get to picture 35. Would you like to keep going, or do you want to stop here and then talk again next week and finish the next half of the pictures or so?
Let me just see what I got on. Yeah, I have a 2:00 with my spiritual director that I do need to do before I start my course. So I think actually, Gary, we're good right now halfway. So, you know, I think, you know, I'll probably run out of energy soon after all that diatribe I just gave you. And I think that I've definitely got a little bit of a aha there that I want to process over the next week.
Okay, so let's do this then. I assume you're saying let's finish this up next week, the pictures?
Yeah.
Okay. So let's do this. Let's next week, in fact, if you want to schedule a time right now, get on the calendar, let's do that. Now I'm going to be gone Thursday through Sunday doing another calling intensive workshop, so probably mid to late week would be good for me. So,
okay, Wednesday?
Let's look at this. Let me pull up my calendar right here. And I'm talking about this. Yeah. So Wednesday would be perfect. You want to do it at the same time? Or what time on Wednesday works for you? I'm open.
So I have a 1 o'clock till 2. Then I'm free from 2 till 4. So I could say 10 to 11:30. Do we want to say it'd be 12 o'clock my time, which would be, what time
10.
Would that be for you?
It'd be 10 my time, 2 hours earlier.
Yeah. That works good for me.
Okay, so Wednesday the 4th, 10 o'clock Mountain Time, 12 o'clock Eastern Time.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Perfect.
Okay, so in the meantime, and you've already completed this, so we'll do the remainder of the picture just like we're doing now. But the other thing I'd like you to do, and maybe you could just do it in the moment, though doing this with 35 pictures may be a little hard. I'd like you, at the end of our conversation next time, I'd like you to go back and then pick out, if you could only have 3 pictures, you could only keep 3, everything else has to go, what would those 3 pictures be? So just be thinking about
of
that.
Of what we've done so far?
No, of all the pictures. So after next week, after we go through the remaining pictures together, like we've just done now with the first half, then I'll ask you, let's go back and you pick out what you believe are the core 3 pictures for you of all of those.
Okay.
And so that would be your kind of assignment to do from now till next Wednesday.
Yeah.
But if it would be more helpful to do it in the moment, that's fine. If talking through the rest of them and then doing it, that whatever way you want to do it, but that's where we'll go.
All right. Okay.
Good?
Perfect.
Hey,
thank
John,
you,
this
Gary.
This has been really good. This is it's always a fascinating exercise. A lot of people really kind of complain about having to
really
do this,
good.
But it's amazing, yeah. And I know you use images as well. So, all right.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate it. Okay, thank you, Gary. God bless.
You're welcome. You too. See ya. Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.